If we waited one more day, Benghazi, a city nearly the size of Charlotte, could suffer a massacre that would have reverberated across the region and stained the conscience of the world.
President Obama, from his Libya speech last night, interesting reference to Charlotte, by the way, a city of about 730,000 people, bigger than Boston, Denver, or Washington, D.C., but he said Charlotte, which just coincidentally was just chosen as the site of the Democratic National Convention in 2012, and North Carolina just coincidentally is important to the president's re-election bid. We will hear some more clips from the speech, get your reactions, and talk about it all with Daily Beast senior political writer Peter Beinart. He's also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and author now of The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. And after a string of critics we've heard from recently, he is a supporter of the president's decision. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be with you.
Did you like his Charlotte comparison?
Yeah, you know, I actually hadn't thought about that. But now that you mention it, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I don't think there's anything I don't think it would be a shock to any of us that that presidents think about re-election politics, even when they're discussing war and peace.
You know who liked it? William Crystal liked it. The famous Iraq War, Bush-supporting, Obama-disliking neoconservative from Fox News posted about it on Weekly Standard as the president getting it about putting things in human terms in a speech. He said Reagan used comparisons like that effectively. And that was interesting coming from William Crystal. I think there's a strange confluence between liberal internationalists, maybe like you and the president, and neocons like Crystal and Paul Wolfowitz on Libya, isn't there?
It's not strange, actually. I mean, in some ways, the origins of what we think of as neoconservatism today, which is radically different than the neoconservatism of the 1970s, really comes out of the break that people like Crystal and Wolfowitz and Robert Kagan made on Bosnia. Remember, in the 1990s, the dominant Republican Party mood was pretty isolationist, and Crystal and Wolfowitz set themselves apart by supporting the U.S. interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo. And so I think then they created a space in which a certain group of conservatives would be supportive of humanitarian intervention. Now, their rationale was not exactly the same as those made by, let's say, you know, liberals like, say, Samantha Power. But still, there was a confluence there. And so it's not surprising to me at all, actually, since Libya is very much the son of Bosnia and Kosovo, that you would see this again.
So the Samantha Powers of the world want human rights, genocide prevention, first of all, and the Crystals of the world want, what, American dominance?
Yeah, I would put it this way. I think for people like Samantha Power and other liberal hawks, American power is the only way to, in a circumstance like this, to prevent genocide or some mass humanitarian slaughter. Now, we of course want it in support, and it's important to say, in the context of international coalition, it's, you know, this has UN support. Kosovo had not UN, but it had NATO support. Mm-hmm. Bosnia had NATO support. So that's something they prioritize more. I think for the neoconservatives, it's not that the humanitarian issues don't matter at all, but I think for them, I would say, at the risk of being a little ungenerous, it's more that the humanitarian issue is a vehicle for the expression of American power. And what's important is the expression of American power as essentially a message to our adversaries.
Let me play a clip of the president's speech that goes to something you've also written about. The question, basically, if we go into Libya to stop a dictator's slaughter, don't we have to go into Syria and Bahrain and Ivory Coast to do the same thing?
Much of the debate in Washington has put forward a false choice when it comes to Libya. On the one hand, some question why America should intervene at all, even in limited ways, in this distant land. They argue that there are many places in the world where innocent civilians face brutal violence at the hands of their government, and America should not be expected to police the world, particularly when we have so many pressing needs here at home. It's true that America cannot use our military wherever repression occurs. And given the costs and risks of intervention, we must always measure our interests against the need for action. But that cannot be an argument for never acting on behalf of what's right. In this particular country, Libya, at this particular moment, we were faced with the prospect of violence on a horrific scale. We had a unique ability to stop that violence, an international mandate for action, a broad coalition prepared to join us, the support of Arab countries, and a plea for help from the Libyan people themselves. We also had the ability to stop Gaddafi's forces in their tracks without putting American troops on the ground.
About a minute and a half of the president's speech last night. We have a few clips yet to come. Peter Beinart, my guest from The Daily Beast and the New America Foundation and author of The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. Peter, that was the key moment of the speech for a lot of people. Was it for you?
No, actually, it wasn't for me, I would say. For me, the key moment of the speech was when he spoke in personal terms, saying, I refused to let this happen. For me, that was, Obama doesn't speak that way very frequently. He's, as many people have said, he's a cool guy, and his coolness is part of his strength and part of his political weakness. For me, the striking moments in the speech were the moments of which were almost Bush-like in their, you know, in their sense of taking personal responsibility for this, in terms of his own sense of self. And I think those, for me, were the most powerful parts of the speech, because I think a lot of Obama's foreign policy speeches and his speeches on Afghanistan, I think, have been weak, in particular because you don't feel like he's that emotionally invested in them. I felt, listening to this speech, that I was struck by how emotionally invested he seemed in this, and that was, for me, the most important part of it.
And I think we have the main part of that you're talking about. So let's listen to another minute of President Obama from last night.
To brush aside America's responsibility as a leader, and more profoundly, our responsibilities to our fellow human beings under such circumstances, would have been a betrayal of who we are. Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. And as president, I refuse to wait for the images of slaughter and mass graves before taking action. Moreover, America has an important strategic interest in preventing Gaddafi from overrunning those who oppose him. A massacre would have driven thousands of additional refugees across Libya's borders, putting enormous strains on the peaceful yet fragile transitions in Egypt and Tunisia. The democratic impulses that are dawning across the region would be eclipsed by the darkest form of dictatorship, as repressive leaders concluded that violence is the best strategy to cling to power.
Peter, was that it?
Yeah, particularly the beginning part. I think it was very significant. You know, the rap against Obama on the right very often, and John Bolton, Bush's former U.N. ambassador, just said it yesterday, a couple of days ago, that Barack Obama doesn't believe in American exceptionalism. He doesn't believe we're any different than any other nation. We don't have any special mission. And that speech, that part of that speech shows that that's just nonsense. And actually, this is what I wrote about today in the Daily Beast. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama absolutely does believe that America has a special mission, and in a certain kind of American exceptionalism. But what makes it different, and what to me makes it far more compelling, it is not the belief that America is fated to do good in the world, that is simply inherent and natural to who we are. Because Obama, unlike people like Bolton and Bush and Cheney, understands and is willing to talk about the dark side of American history. Those guys only talk about America struggling against evil somewhere else, like the Nazis or the communists. He always refers to the civil rights movement, which was a struggle against the evil within us. But for him, I think the intervention in Libya is part of America's capacity to transcend that tendency, the struggle to be different, not the fact that we are inherently different, but the struggle to prove that we can be different, even though we have the same capacities to do evil or to be indifferent to evil as anybody else. And I think that, for me, was why that particular part of the speech was very compelling.
It's a more nuanced definition of American exceptionalism, one that is defined by the process and by the ideals, rather than to say, hey, we're just better than everybody else. We've mastered this from 200 years ago.
Yeah, it's to say that our American exceptionalism is a struggle. American exceptionalism is a struggle against the evil that resides within us. In this regard, I think people have talked about the influence of the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr on Obama, and Niebuhr is someone who I've written a lot about. But I think that's the Niebuhr tradition. That's the way Niebuhr talked about the Cold War, not as America inherently being better than the Soviet Union, but America's own recognition of its own fallibility being the key to not being like the Soviet Union. And I think that's a theme that I think comes through, and I think a certain kind of way came through in the speech last night.
Listeners, your reactions to President Obama's Libya speech last night, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, from left, right, or other, neocon, neo-lib, whatever you are, 212-433-9692, your reactions to the president's speech if you watched it or heard it. Gary in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Oh, hi. I wasn't sure if Peter intended to say this, but he said essentially that the neoconservatives just want to project American power, but I think they want to back up vital strategic interests, and if there's humanitarianism involved, all the more. That's pretty much what Iraq was, wasn't it?
So, in other words, rather than making the endpoint American power, making the endpoint American national security and American defense, and then if they can do humanitarian good along the way, then it's even better?
Yeah. In other words, it's not projection of power per se. And I thought it was relatively new that Obama, well, I guess Obama had to come up with some version of his own version of American exceptionalism, finally, but I don't think he ever expressed it that way before.
Gary, thank you. Peter, what about that? What about instead of ending the definition of neoconservatism at American power for its own sake, American power to protect national security interests?
Yes, that's sure, of course. I think the one of the problems I would argue with with neoconservatism, again, as it exists in this generation, not as it existed in the generation of some of Bill Kristol's father, Irving Kristol, is that there is actually no limit to the understanding of American interests, that there is essentially a perpetual process of needing to try to expand the frontiers of American dominance and American power with the essentially an apocalyptic vision of what happens if America ever stops pushing forward and acknowledges that there's any sphere of the world that should be beyond our mastery. And I think that's where it's one of the real problems in terms of neoconservatism as a strategy. There's no understanding that you have to match up goals with means, that American resources are limited. And I think to Obama, you know, what Obama, you can criticize him from this, but Obama did have some recognition in that speech that America's capacities and resources in Libya are limited. We're not going to go in with ground troops, and we're not going to lead this mission. Now, that may well mean that the mission does not succeed in the way we would most like it to succeed with, you know, Gaddafi leaving power, or at least leaving power anytime soon. But he did put a sense of limits on the mission, and I think it's something that neoconservatives rarely do.
Mm-hmm. Alex in Jamaica, you're on WNYC with Peter Beinart. Hi, Alex.
Oh, yes, hello, Bon. Hello, Peter. My only point is that it seems amazingly hypocritical if we're dealing with humanitarian reasons for doing this invasion or this bombing, not invasion, that they don't look at other countries like Zimbabwe, like the DRC, where 5 million people have been killed over 10 years.
Congo.
And yeah, Congo. And it just doesn't seem like he's given enough of a reason why we're not going into these places. He's given somewhat of a reason for us to go into Libya, but it seems as if the Congo's destabilizing Central Africa and all sorts of things of that nature seems just as legitimate. So when does he speak to reasons that we're not going to go into places?
Peter, talk to Alex.
Well, he did talk about that. And I think there are lots of good reasons to be concerned about this objection, about this military intervention. I myself have mixed feelings about it, although probably at the end of the day I come down in support of it. But I think there are a lot of good reasons to be concerned about it. But the argument that we should also be doing this in Congo and Zimbabwe, I don't think is one of them. Prudence, there's nothing wrong with prudential considerations in foreign policy. To put it another way, if you're a doctor and you have two patients in front of you who are dying and you have the tools to save one, there's nothing wrong with saving that one because you can't save the other one.
Why don't we have the tools? Why don't we have the tools?
Well, one of the reasons that we can one of the reasons we can do this in Libya is the same reason we were able to do it in Bosnia and Kosovo. It's simply mere proximity. Proximity and logistics matter a lot in military. Libya, like Bosnia and Kosovo, is on NATO's border. Zimbabwe and Congo, simply as military operations, are much, much harder because of what part of the world they're in. It's also precisely because Libya is on the back door of France and Italy that those countries were willing to come forward in an aggressive way and support this, because they believe that what happens in Libya will affect them like what happens in Mexico affect us. Those are the realities. There's nothing wrong with recognizing those realities exist in the real world. Does that say we shouldn't do anything for Congo and Zimbabwe? No. But there will always be terrible, terrible things that happen in the world, and it will always be way beyond America's capacity to stop all of them, particularly in a military sense. So the real world choice, and I think Obama was right here, is humanitarian intervention never, or humanitarian intervention occasionally. Humanitarian intervention always to stop every humanitarian slaughter is simply never going to be in this world a possibility.
Alex, how much did he convince you?
But that requires you to believe then that there's a grim calculus that gets done, that, you know, 5 million people in the DRC over 10 years means that we have no capacity to militarily to affect that, but thousands of people in Libya, because it's a little closer to Europe, we do have ability to affect that, and we should. And it just seems that if it's something that's the right thing to do, it should be the right thing to do, even if it's hard or if it's easy. You should be able to work around the logistical situation from it, logistical situation,
right,
and make it happen.
Alex, thank you. Go ahead.
The issue is, as a president, you have an obligation to be honest with yourself and with the American people about the American people's willingness to sacrifice for these kind of missions. And you can't be naive about it. And the truth of the matter is, and this was made pretty clear in the Balkans, Americans are not willing to sacrifice many American lives for humanitarian interventions where our security is not at stake. That's just fact. You look at what happened in Somalia. When America went into Somalia to save people from dying, and we lost 18 American Marines, the cries for pulling out immediately became deafening. And that is the political backdrop behind Obama's unwillingness to send U.S. ground troops. Does that make us an immoral people? You can make your own decision about that, but if you're going to say something like that, you need to think about whether you'd be willing to sign up and volunteer for that mission yourself, or have your son and daughter do it. It's not crazy that Americans don't like to lose their sons and daughters when they don't feel like their own security is at stake, and that creates real constraints on what humanitarian intervention can be. That's why those were air wars in Bosnia and Kosovo, and that's part of the calculation here.
Alex, thank you for your call. Unfortunately, the people of sub-Saharan Africa seem to always get hung out to dry. But the key question...
Let me say one more thing about this. If you want to create a widening circle of humanitarian concern in which we might one day be more likely to do it in Congo or Zimbabwe, I still think you should do it in Libya, because, in fact, it's precisely the precedent of a successful humanitarian intervention, as happened in Bosnia and Kosovo. If that hadn't happened, we wouldn't even be discussing Libya now. And so I think it's actually in the long-term interest of people everywhere for humanitarian intervention to be done successfully anywhere.
We're almost out of time, but the key question for me along these lines is, what about the larger Arab democracy movement? Does stopping Gaddafi through the use of force actually send a message to other dictators in the region, as the president claimed, that the world will back up the democracy movement? Or does it pin the U.S. and NATO down in Libya and actually give new space to the dictators and monarchs in the region to slaughter with impunity, because we can't go into everywhere? Look what's happening at the same time in Syria. Maybe no coincidence.
I like at the end of the day, it doesn't really make much difference one way or the other. I don't think that there was much real chance that the U.S. was going to intervene militarily in Syria or anywhere in the Gulf because of the very, very difficult political situations that would be there. I don't think probably, and I think precisely because people know that we're not going to intervene there, what we're doing in Libya is not going to have that much of an impact. But I do think it will have a very big impact on the way we're seen by the people of Libya, and I think that's important.
Peter Beinart, senior political writer for The Daily Beast, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and author of The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and you can keep posting your reactions to the president's speech and the Libya policy generally to our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Still to come, we will review that prefab apartment building now being planned for Atlantic Yards, Brooklyn, the latest interesting controversy in the Atlantic Yards saga. And then we'll go behind the ivy walls of the college admission process as many of you await the fateful moment. Stay with us.